This morning we'll take up koan number 84 from the Hekigon Roku. And there is an introduction, but we won't read it. We'll come to it after we've read the case. That is in the interest of getting to the point as quickly as we can. And the case reads, Vumala Kirti asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Vimala Kirti, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? And then there's the verse. Foolish Vimala Kirti, sorrowful for sentient beings, you lie sick in Bayali, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes, the room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate of the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manjushri's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. And then, so let's go to the introduction then. And it starts off by saying, though you say it is, there is nothing that it is can affirm. In Dokusan yesterday, somebody came and complained about the teishos, saying they were too difficult, and asked what I meant by the trap of words. Now, this person, because of the trap of words, can only say so much. After that, it is entirely up to you. Of course, you're going to be puzzled by this trap of words. But instead of complaining, one must take that as a challenge. What does that mean? The trap of words. What is this trap of words? There must be a good third, if not more, of the koans which address this problem specifically. And this, of course, is one of the most famous. And this is why in the introduction it comes straight in with the whole problem. Though you say it is, there is nothing it is can affirm. And as we said, this is the revolution of Buddhism. It is in that statement that Buddha and the masters throw down the gauntlet. We were talking yesterday about the Vedic and the Upanishadic traditions. And they always presumed that there was some substratum, Brahman, a supreme being, something beyond it all. And we get the same in Christianity. And, of course, the whole Greek legacy has given us this notion of a being. It's quite interesting that it's only just recently, with the work of Heidegger, that this whole notion of being has been challenged fundamentally. But Buddhism has been challenging it ever since Buddha first opened his mouth. One of the things is that we believe that there's a kind of eternity of time, and that things occur within this eternity of time. There is a feeling, for example, that time was before I was born, and time will be after I'm dead. There is this notion that's been used somewhat in science fiction, the notion of time travel, of people experimenting in the laboratory and inadvertently slipping back in time and finding that they're now in the 10th century or something like that. And the whole impression there is this being which includes the being of time. But as we said yesterday or sometime, there wasn't one World War II. There were millions of World War IIs. And which one are you going to slip into? From the beginning, not a thing is. And you see, we cannot grasp that, because the belief that of in this eternity of being and the eternity of time comes from the fact we have language, we have words. This very feeling of the ongoingness of consciousness, that consciousness endures, and that things endure, all come from the notion, from words, and the underlying idea that supports those words. But it's words that freezes it, that fixes it. It's like when you take a photograph, you put it through the developer, but then, or at least you used to before digital cameras, but then you have to put it through the fixer. It fixes it. Otherwise, it will just continue to develop until it's just a black sheet. Time, words fix. And to go beyond that is awakening. One awakens to the trap of words, among other things. And even then, the first awakening will not very often reveal it, the trap of words, in its fullness. When you're working on Mu is it. When we work with Mu, whether we like it or not, there is the experience or the anticipation or the expectation that beyond Mu there is something. This comes with the very expression Mu. With that comes being. When we inquire into what am I, we've constantly warned you, watch out, there's a trap here. And the trap is, I'm asking you, what are you? And there is a what, that. And so you're going to look for the what, that what you are. We try to, at one series of talks we gave, to break that and point out that there is what you are and that you are. And what you are has content, but that you are has no content whatsoever. But it's in this The trap of words that we must look for our deliverance. As we said yesterday, this person, for a long time, could not accept that such insignificant things as words could tie down the magnificence of the human spirit. It was totally incompatible in this person's view. And it was one of the things that really woke us up to struggling to try to see into what does this mean then? And it was as a consequence both of deep thought and meditation and also some reading that one realized that the evocative power of words, to say it is, brings the whole thing into being. The whole stage is set with it is. People, this questioner actually said to me that the it doesn't mean anything as far as she's concerned. But of course it does. Of course it does. Reflect on it again. See into this. It is raining. In other words, there is a beingness established with it is raining. And he says, though you say it is, there is nothing it is can affirm. The Koreans use the koan, what is it? And this itself indicates that this it is not at all innocuous. Though you say it is, there is nothing it is can affirm. Though you say it is not, there is nothing that it is not can negate. Don't let that slip by. This Joshua's no, what is the no negating? This we pointed out that the ambiguous nature of no yesterday as well, or nothing, or not knowing, no self, the whole of the Prajnaparamita, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no. What is it negating? It cannot be negating the nose. You blow your nose. How can you negate it? And yet it is saying no nose, no eye, no ear. Now why? What is going on here? And it's no good throwing up your hands and saying, well, I don't know, this is all stupid to me. There's something so profound here. This is the revolution of Buddhism. It was this that transformed the Far East, and it had brought about an entirely different kind of civilization as a consequence. It's an enormous power in this Joshua's mu, this no, no eye, no ear, no self. What is it negating? To say it is not, what are we negating? There is nothing to negate except what words have created. He says, when is and is not are gone beyond, gain and loss are no more. It's not only gain and loss. It's life and death. What are you? There it is. There is that isness. That is the being. What being are you? We sometimes try to say it's like a fountain. But even a fountain has got drops of water. There's an endurance there. But there is nothing that endures. Nothing that endures. there is a Buddhist belief that the world is coming in and going out of being in instants. But no, it is not even coming into being for an instant. And there is no knowing. There is no substratum of knowing or being. We talk about knowing and being. And because we talk about it, inevitably, one's going to have the feeling that there is that kind of, well, a kind of matrix there, a kind of extended something or other which will bring it into being. But there is nothing. It is not nothing. How can we say this? And this is what this koan is about. How can we get beyond this? Yesterday we talked about the man, the monk that walked away. Brilliant. And then he says, all is open and unobstructed. This zendo, this the house, the grounds, the street, the whole of Montreal is open and unobstructed. There is a samadhi which one can enter into, in which one really sees into the non-obstructed nature of existence. We say that the idea of reality that most people have comes from a tension, a fundamental tension that is always with them. And it is this, that it is the power or the strength or the there-ness of the sensation that arises from this tension that is what they are calling the reality of the world. That is the obstructed aspect of the world. The world obstructs because it is real. And it is real because it has been fixed in words. And this samadhi is when one gets upstream of this tension, and so the words lose their power. And there it is an unobstructed universe. One can walk through walls. And then he says, now I want to ask you, what is in front of me and what is behind? Can you see how this question inevitably arises? Who is the me? What is in front? What is behind? It's exactly like the question, where are you from? It fixes. There is a location. We are all from somewhere. But supposing there is no me, no in front of, no behind, how are you going to answer that question then? It's like a master said, once you have a speck of dust, you have the universe. Once you have one word, you have innumerable universes. He says, some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Here it might be someone would say, well, there's the altar in front and the entrance to the zendo, and behind there's the emergency exit and the monitor seats. But that all comes because we have laid out with the words and thoughts, ideas that we have. We've laid it out. We've fixed it. And we've fixed everything like that, including the 10th century into which I can go if I'm not careful when I'm working in my laboratory. As we say, once upon a time, the people that had the ability to use words were magicians. Because just as there are people now that have difficulty writing, so once upon a time there would have been people that have been had difficulty speaking. People would have been had to be taught to speak in the same way that we are now taught to write. We take it all for granted. I mean, this is the terrible part about it, that words are now rubbish. I've got a stack of newspapers I want to throw away. I've got books I don't know what to do with. There's junk mail constantly coming and hammering at me. There's advertisements everywhere I look. I go on the metro, and everywhere I look, there's words are shouting at me. And no wonder we have depreciated it. It's out of self-defense. But now let's step back. Really examine this. Spend some time on it, not necessarily on the sesshin, but think it through. As I say, this book, Creating Consciousness, goes into it. Work with this. He says, some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and a temple, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Tell me, is that man open-eyed? And then as he says, if you can see through him, I will acknowledge you have seen the ancient worthy. What is the ancient worthy? Why does he call it the ancient worthy? Why does Goethe, when anybody asks him a question, hold up a finger? Perhaps we could just, you know, this comes from the Vimalakirti Sutra, this particular koan. And you know the story that Vimalakirti was sick, and the Buddha told Manjushri to take the people along to visit Vimalakirti in his sickness. And this is really what this foolish Vimalakirti, sorrowful for sentient beings. You lie sick in Vayali, your body all withered up. That verse is referring to the fact that Vimalakirti was sick. And one of the questions, actually, that Manjushri asks Vimalakirti is, why are you sick? And Vimalakirti says, I am sick because the whole world is sick. There are people sometimes, they tell me, they say, I don't suffer. And these people are in such a self-conceited cocoon that they are untouched by the terrible suffering that there is in the world. There always has been. When one really sees into this, that we suffer because we are human, is no longer my suffering or your suffering. It doesn't come like that. This is what, remember the mustard seed, when Buddha sent the woman whose baby had died to find a mustard seed. But it had to come from a house that had not known suffering. And the woman went back and said, yes, I can find a house with a mustard seed, but I cannot find a house that has not known suffering. What Buddha was saying was, it's not, well, cheer up, everybody suffers. It's not that. But when one sees it in its true perspective, then there is no such thing as my suffering. And it is this really that is the true bodhisattva spirit. It doesn't mean to say that one has got to go around being miserable all day. It's not at all. But it's moving out of this me and mine, you and yours. And Vimalakirti was quite crumbs in the bed, you might say, as far as the bodhisattvas were concerned, the disciples of Buddha, because he was always challenging them to dharma duels. And in these dharma duels, it's a very fine sutra, and it's got a very fine translation as well. I think it's Robert Thurman that did it. It is very good, and it is one of the sutras that is most accessible. Again, it's not accessible like your novel is accessible. You have to work at it. And he's talking about the body of the Tathagata. You remember yesterday we talked about the Tathagata and we said, thus come. But we said we preferred to say, come to. And perhaps you get some feel now for why come to is so appropriate. And he's talking about the body of the Tathagata. And he says that it is born of knowing, the body of the Tathagata. This reminds me of Nisargadatta, who said, my body is peace. My body is peace. It's a beautiful expression. It's like the man who said, the master who said, the fields, the hills, and so on are my face. But peace is my body. And now, Vilma Lakirti is saying, knowing is my body. If you can see it, knowing is not something. It is going on, but it's not something that is going on. There is no something which is going on. This is why he's saying that the Tathagata, the body of the Tathagata, is knowing. Come to is knowing. He says, it is born of discipline. The body of the Tathagata is discipline. Again, it is not there is something which disciplines itself. It is discipline. It's born of practice, prajna, of awakening, and of the perfection of awakening. There's a kind of progression there. There's a progression from the born of discipline to the perfection of awakening. But what is it that is awakened? The Tathagata's body is discipline. And then the Tathagata's body is the perfection of awakening. And then he says, it is born of love and compassion, joy and impartiality. Now, if you can see this, we think that all of these things, joy, impartiality, wisdom, discipline, practice, are all attributes of a person, that you must have a person, and then you have these attributes. But it's the other way around. There are these attributes, and then they are lost in the person. This is what he's saying, what Vilma Lakirti is saying, of course, is what we say in a very sort of bald way, you are whole and complete. This whole and complete is something that is very sort of prosaic. But when he says, you are love and compassion, joy and impartiality, this is your true nature. This is the body of the Tathagata. But the unfortunate part about it is when we say, you are this, you immediately take it on as me, the personality. But it's because of the fact that we have become enmeshed in this need to be something special, the need to be in the first place, and then something special, that we have turned our back on the body of the Tathagata. And we've turned our back on this truth that it is born of gentleness and patience. It is born of the roots of virtue planted by constant effort. It is born of concentration, insight, meditation, and absorption. These are not the attributes of the Tathagata. In other words, there isn't a Tathagata that has these attributes. He's saying the body of the Tathagata. And then I pointed out to you that this body is used in the way that Nirsagadatta says, my body is peace. And he says, you should turn your aspiration toward such a body. And in order to eliminate the sickness of the passions of all living beings, you should arouse the wish for unexcelled, perfect awakening. In other words, if we can dwell just for a moment on this brilliance that we are, that of the body of the Tathagata, discipline, prajna, love, compassion, joy, impartiality, if one can see that we've turned our back on this brilliance, and then he says we must arouse the wish for perfect, unexcelled awakening. This is what is also known in Buddhism as the bodhicitta. Arouse the mind that seeks the way. This is the awakening before the awakening. This is when one says, right, I'll drop everything else, but this is of utmost importance. Up till then, one has practiced. But when one can just get an inkling of the brilliance of this body of the Tathagata, it comes as a moment's flash. Then nothing is too much. No hardship is too great. And then there is this other wonderful statement that we do want to read. And he says, noble sir, flowers like the lotus, the water lily, and the moon lily do not grow on the dry ground in the desert. They grow in the swamps and in the mud. In the same way, the Buddha qualities do not grow in living beings who are already awake, but in those living beings who are like swamps of mud and negative emotions. And this acts as a wonderful counterpoint to what he has been saying about the body of the Tathagata. Who hasn't looked inside and seen not only the negative emotions, the sort of the bitterness of the past, the regrets, the shame, the wishing that something had not ever been done or even ever thought? It's not only that, but when one sees one's weak efforts one's puny efforts in the face of this. When one realizes how much time one wastes, even when the opportunity to practice is unparalleled. One wonders, is there really any kind of hope for me? And this is precisely what Vimalakirti is saying. It is precisely in that weakness, in that shame, in that regret, in that sense of somehow a lingering sense of failure. It's in there that the lotus of awakening grows. He says, in a similar way, a seed does not grow in the sky, but on the earth. So the Buddha's qualities do not grow in those who are already saints, but in those who seek awakening after having built a mountain of egoistic views as high as Mount Everest. One of the sad things is that people come into practice and they practice for a couple of weeks and then they pretend that they're awakened. So often people come into the Doksan room and want somehow to convey to me that they're awakened. And very often these are the people who are most badly off. You know, Emerson came up with that saying, what you are speaks so loud, I cannot hear what you say. He says, noble sir, by the same token, one can understand that the family of Tathagatas includes all our passions. There are no good and bad passions. There are no good and bad thoughts. Another question that often troubled this person was when I've sort of surveyed my life. Although I had considerable shame for what I'd done and what I hadn't done, nevertheless, I could never see how anybody could tell me that I would have to burn in hell for an eternity because of them. We must really feel that we have the right to move into any area within our spiritual landscape. We must not feel that anything is too bad, too awful. There is nothing in you that this person would not find, and any other person that would work on themselves would not find also. If we are going to burn in hell, we're all going there. Includes all our passions. For example, noble sir, without going into the great ocean, it is impossible to find precious, priceless pearls. Likewise, without going into the ocean of passions, one cannot reach the mind of pure knowing. On another occasion, he was talking to Sariputra, and he said, you should absorb yourself in contemplation, you should practice in such a way that you engage in all ordinary behavior without losing awareness. And this really is an essential element of practice. It is not enough that we sit on the mat for an hour or even 2 hours a day. unless we really struggle to maintain awareness during the day. And in order to do that, we must want to be aware. And if you look into yourself honestly, most of us do not want to be aware during the day. Because being aware during the day means that we have to let go of all of our fantasies, all of our imagination, all of those dreams by which we buffer ourselves against the contradictions that we inherently are. When we are present, there is very often a sense of discomfort, a kind of inner restlessness, a sense of, well, it's an unpleasant, almost, it's an indescribable, unpleasant feeling. And all of these dreams and thoughts and even all of, most often, negative emotions, resentments and bitterness and so on, are ways by which we mask ourselves or hide ourselves from this unpleasant, uncomfortable feeling. And this is why we don't want to wake up. When we chant the four vowels, we must chant a fifth vowel, or it is implicit there is a fifth vowel. And that is indeed that we will be present. And you must make up your mind. It's not, we don't practice simply to come to awakening, for God's sake, but to be present. And if we are present, there is a chance that we may be able to fill a small aspect of the four vowels that we chant so easily. And he says you should practice in such a way that you can manifest the nature of an ordinary person without losing your cultivated spiritual nature. In other words, one goes on acting as it's not as an ordinary person. You go on acting as a person. You are what you are. There's no need for us to get bald heads and fancy dress and fancy names and all the rest of it in order to tell people and other people how Buddhist and enlightened and whatever we are. This is the very thing that we must undercut. That sense that there is something special. And again, we're not saying you should manifest as a mediocre person. No, one can strive, one can want to get ahead, one can want to do things in the world, one can want to change the world. There's nothing wrong with any of that. Helping other, nothing wrong with any of that. It's the inner approach by which we do it. That letting go of that claim that we have on other people and on ourselves to excel. He says he practices in such a way that the mind neither settles within nor moves without toward external forms. This is this movement of the mind we keep on bringing to your attention. It's unnecessary. It is unnecessary to think, to know. One can know without thinking. And in such a way that you can follow all ways without becoming attached to any, without becoming identified, and above all, without being identified to Zen Buddhism. He says, in such a way that you are released in liberation without abandoning the passions that are the province of the world. There's a statement for you. And then let's just turn then to the koan. And he says that Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? The Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only. What is that one and only? What is this gate? as you know, the Mumon Khan is the gateless gate. Why is it a gateless gate? And why does he use this strange expression? Why doesn't he say, what are you? Or what is reality? Or what is truth? Why does he use this, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? It's not because he wants to use fancy phrases. In that question, there is a great deal to meditate on. As we say, why one and only? Remember Buddha's statement, throughout heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. I alone am the one and only. There are not a lot of Buddhas. This is why we chant from the beginning, all beings are Buddha, the one and only. So what is that one and only? What is Buddha? And then Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all, there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. And notice this, no words. This is what we have been saying. Why does he pick on that? What is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Why doesn't Manjushri say, well, it's Zazen? Why doesn't he say it's prayers or chanting? Why does he go straight to, in my mind, there are no words? Why pick words? Of course, having heard three teishos now on words, you're not surprised. But nevertheless, this is a fascinating thing that Manjushri goes straight for the words. All the other bodhisattvas, because a whole lot of them had already done their thing, but Manjushri picks on the words. And this is really what the whole thing is about, the whole sutra in a way is about. He says no words, no talking, and then no activity of consciousness. Consciousness and words are inextricably tied. It's like name and form. Nama and rupa in Sanskrit are inextricably bound up. Once one sees that, and once one sees that we overvalue consciousness, we give it a value far beyond its worth. What we're doing is we're giving value to this verbal structure, this world of ideas, this third world of Papa that we spoke about yesterday. That is supremely important when we think consciousness is supremely important. And yet, is it? Where are you when a bird sings? And then he says, it's beyond all questions and answers. Beyond all questions and answers. Beyond all possibility of being discovered. Beyond all possibility of being found through questioning or finding theories and solutions and so on. This Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only. This Bodhisattva's gate to you. You are beyond all questions and answers. So what about this question, what is Mu or what are you? What about that now? Before the question arises then, what are you? He says, that is entering the gate to the one and only. But what's wrong with what Manjushri has just said? What is wrong with all of that? For example, if you came into the Dokusan room and I said, okay, what are you? And you said, to my mind, in all, there are no words. So then Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only?
Four vows.
All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow passions, I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way.